This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run, Thursday the 19th of May, 6 o'clock in the morning. Rise and shine to those who've just woken up and drive safely to those who are driving on the roads. I'm Melissa Idris and I've got Julian Ng here with me this morning. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning.
So we had a bit of a night out yesterday.
Yeah,
met
we did.
Some people from various industries. I think it was really good to have a bit of networking. And we often kind of get stuck in the studio, in this office, and never get to meet the people that we're actually talking to.
That's right. So it was very refreshing to have those conversations yesterday. And along with that, have a little bit of wine as well. I have to admit, I enjoyed that.
Okay, but now it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and we're geared up for a new day. And coming up on the show today, we've got a really good lineup. In fact, today on The Breakfast Grill, we're going to be focusing on Latin American trade, specifically the Pacific Alliance, which is a Latin American trade bloc, which has some features of further integration. And at the moment, it's got Chile, Colombia, Mexico and Peru, which all border the Pacific Ocean, and they're all members of this alliance.
You know, these countries are so far away, and oftentimes we don't really think about their potential because we think we have this home country bias, right? We think Malaysia is best, and that's reflected in our investment actions as well. Most of our investments are at home. And then if I ask somebody, hey, do you want to invest in Chile or do you want to invest in Mexico or Costa Rica, right? I guess the reaction would be one of either mild disagreement or a violent no for that. So I think these countries are strong growing countries in that part of the world, especially with the fact that they have America in their backyard and are selling to America.
So you know how we often talk about emerging markets, and whenever we think emerging markets, we think this corner of the world, but we don't think about how fast Mexico is growing, for instance, or Costa Rica is growing. We don't think about those burgeoning economies. And I think today it'll be really interesting to see how the economies are faring and also how they're working together as a part of a trade bloc. Perhaps ASEAN could learn a thing or two from this Pacific Alliance.
Well, they have the big brother called the United States of America looking over their shoulder. So these are very small countries. And apart from the economics, they have to manage that relationship with big brother as well. Just as we do, we have a lot of trade with China. And China is, of course, lurking in the background, trying to expand their territories. And we have to find a way to manage that diplomatically without spoiling the rice bowl as well.
You know, the big brother aspect of it could be made a lot more complicated if there is a President Trump, you know, and the wall,
yes,
and the, you know, the his comments,
especially
about
what he said about Mexico.
Yes, exactly. So how are they going to deal with that? Should there be a President Trump? What will the relationship of this trade alliance with the US be? And, you know, just a quick note on is the ASEAN Economic Cooperation, the AEC, is that something? Do we want to model ourselves after the Pacific Alliance, for instance? Are we going to be, you know, we're essentially going to be a trade bloc? And is that an alliance we want to kind of shape ourselves after? Or is it something like the European Union, which is suffering so many, you know, it's really getting fractured over the years?
Yeah, that's a confusing one because there is an explicit intention that ASEAN, the AEC, does not want to become like the European Union. But they have these European Union-like features like free movement of capital and labor and things like that. So the status of ASEAN right now is very confused. And I think it's worsened by the fact that the cultures are so different. And they may not want to give and take in terms of opening up, right? People are, let's say, going to be quite afraid of opening up, having Singapore there as a very advanced member of the ASEAN. I guess Singapore is the Germany of ASEAN.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, actually, that could be true.
Yeah, so there are all these things to think about.
Okay, so Sharad Kutan will be speaking to a panel of guests about the Pacific Alliance on The Breakfast Grill today. His Excellency Carlos Felix Corona, the Ambassador of Mexico to Malaysia, as well as Dr. Lili Yulyaidi, the head for the Centre of Latin American Studies at University Malaya. That's 8 o'clock, The Breakfast Grill. And after The Grill, we have Current Affairs. Now, if you remember, I think it was late last month, where there was news that two PDRM officers and a sergeant will be deployed in the Selangor State Religious Department, or JAIS, to assist in Sharia law enforcement. Now, this collaboration has raised concerns as to whether PDRM will start practicing moral policing in their duties. So today we're going to explore the main objective and also the legal aspects behind the collaboration of the police and also the religious state department.
I think this is a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you are giving advice on how the state religious department should carry out their work. And on the other hand, you're giving this legal backing and legal enforcement right. to that department.
So, you know, that there have been two kind of camps to this argument. The one that has supported it, and I'm very surprised at the people who've come out to support it, saying that, you know, this is actually a good move because there have been reports where the religious authorities have not done things by the book, you know, late-night raids and etc. So they say having the police there to teach the religious department, you know, the right SOPs, how to work within the legal framework. So a lot of people are applauding this move. On the other hand, there are those who are very concerned about the unintended consequences of having the police lend their authority and all their enforcement might behind you know, state religious authorities, whether this might open up a whole new can of worms that we didn't intend. So we're going to be discussing this on Current Affairs today. I think it's going to be a really robust discussion, so make sure you tune in with that. We've got people from JAIS speaking to us as well, so we get their point of view. That's at 8:35 a.m. Or if you can't catch that episode, show, just download the podcast at our website. Okay, Current Ringgit and Sense is on today as well, yes. Julian. What is on the show today at 9:35?
An insurance man is going to come to demystify insurance policy. You know, you get all these terms, they sound like Greek to me many times. what's a term policy? What's a whole life? What are endowment? What are investment-linked policies? What are riders? Who should get what?
Yes. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I know that I should have insurance, but the terms are confusing to me. And I will just take the advice of my insurance agent, and therefore it's purely trust. So I have an insurance agent who is my friend, and I just trust him completely to kind of provide me with the best option, I guess, and the cheapest option, or one that fits my lifestyle and budget. But I want to know more about it. So, you know, you make an informed decision rather than blind trust.
Yeah, this would be kind of episode where it would be very useful for you to listen to before you see your insurance agent. At least you have some background information and you know how to use the lingo. More importantly, you know the concepts behind the different policies. And the guy who's going to come in to talk about this is none other than Ravinder Singh, founder of You for Life. Company that has started a website selling very cheap insurance, not necessarily bad insurance. Cheap doesn't mean that it's no good, and it's very useful because it helps people buy into this very affordable products and
it's like
immediately
no frills
mm-hmm. yeah, and immediately get the kind of protection that they need. He's also general manager of life and health for Hanover Re, which is a reinsurance company.
Okay, so insurance is the focus of Ringgit and Sense today, 9:35 a.m. It's now 6:09, and here's your daily news roundup to start your day. We've got Dato' Sri Nazir Razak resuming his role and position as chairman of CIMB Group and director of CIMB Bank starting today. And this is because the review showed that he did not misuse his position, and there was no inappropriate use of the bank's resources when he was group chief executive. If you remember, I think it was almost exactly a month ago to the day that Nazir had announced he would be going on voluntary leave to allow an independent internal review on that $7 million which he had helped disperse to politicians ahead of the 13th general elections.
Yeah, I haven't read the full review yet, but I'm interested to know whether the anti-money laundering laws were violated, whether income tax laws were violated because you channeled $7 million, US$7 million through your accounts. Mm. I'm a little bit skeptical, and I would want to look at that review.
Were you surprised that he was back? I mean, I think because time flies so fast, we didn't realize just how quickly 1 month had passed. But so the comments I got, I mean, the knee-jerk reactions I received was, oh, so fast. You know, yeah. So that was quick.
Yeah, it seemed like yesterday. And I think the review could have been, could have taken a very narrow position of whether internal rules were breached.
Yeah.
And obviously you can come to that conclusion quite easily, but whether national rules were breached or not, that's what I'm interested in.
Okay, let's take a quick look in the US with the presidential elections heating up. Bernie Sanders won yesterday's Democratic presidential primary in Oregon, a victory that is likely to do little more than slow Hillary Clinton's march towards the Democratic nomination. So in Oregon, it was a clear Sanders win with 56% of the vote, the votes against Clinton's 44%. So what do you think about this, Julian?
Well, there was another primary yesterday as well, and that was in Kentucky. Clinton's win there was possibly the narrowest victory so far. She won 46.8% of the votes versus Sanders 46.3%, so just a 0.3 percentage points difference between the two. And I think that this is going to reinforce Sanders' resolve to fight it out and to take this to the Democratic conventions. So it's going to be very exciting. It's like a TV show.
It is. It's like a reality show. It's like one with Donald Trump where he goes around saying, you're fired, you're fired. But have you... have you heard, or, I mean, have you been reading reports about Sanders perhaps considering an independent?
Well, that's Donald Trump goading Sanders into doing that sort of thing. But obviously, it's a move that's really going to divide the Democratic Party and, as it were, to split the opposition's vote, right? Because Donald Trump is a big force, is a huge force right now. And if you're going to split the votes, then you're going to see, sadly, a Trump presidency, which is what a lot of people don't want. So, but I think that personally, this would be at the back of Clinton's mind. And if if Sanders wanted to prevent a Clinton presidency, then Clinton would have to be really nice to Sanders to make sure that he doesn't do that.
So essentially, she's being attacked on both fronts by both Sanders and Trump, who is essentially the Republican presumptive nominee. And speaking about Donald Trump, he's filed a new personal financial disclosure form with the Federal Election Commission. It's a federally mandated document that shows the candidate's personal assets, his business propositions, and also annual income. Now, it's very interesting because, you know, we've all heard the claims Donald Trump has made about how wealthy he is, how rich he is. But in this 104-page financial report, he claims things like his national golf club in Westchester is worth over $50 million. And
wow.
This is despite the fact that his lawyers initially argued it was only worth $1.3 million. In a recent tax dispute. So really quite exaggerated numbers. I don't know, but he seems to claim that he thinks he's worth more than $10 billion.
So Donald Trump seems to be using this method of asset valuation that revolves around plucking figures out of the air, right? Anybody can do that. But the question is, why is this important? Why is it important for Donald Trump to disclose his personal assets? I guess he's trying to project the view that he's a man of his own. He's not going to be a corrupt president, and he can fight. He can be tough with the Chinese and the Mexicans
because he's
rich,
right? Okay.
Because he's rich and he's funding his own campaign, which allows him to be a very independent candidate.
But you know, I mean, much like the rest of his rhetoric, in this report, in this 100 over page financial report, the figures are really kind of vague in large ranges. They're never really specific. And that's just what he is. He likes to talk big, but never with any minute detail, right? It also shows really interestingly Trump's investments in companies like Apple and Amazon, as well as the parent company of Oreo, all of which he has attacked on the campaign trail.
And compare those numbers with somebody like Bernie Sanders. I mean, forget about Clinton, because we know she's very rich too.
She's the got Clintons, huge backing.
Yeah, the Clintons are rich. I think they earned something like $6 million last year for just giving speeches. Right? I would love to. I would love to give that kind of speech. But Bernie Sanders has assets worth $300,000. That's it, right?
$300,000. Okay.
Yeah.
For a presidential nominee, that's not much.
That's miserly. That's poor. Although that actually puts him, takes him out of somebody who's struggling, right? He's in the rich category in the United States as well. I mean, you're not
5%.
You're not poor with that kind of assets. Mm-hmm. Does this really curb Sanders' ability to be independent, for example, which is what Donald Trump is claiming with the kind of wealth he's holding? I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think because of that, Sanders can be even more, can be just as independent as Donald Trump, because he's not imprisoned by the lure of money.
Oh, right? He's not bound to it. Okay, well, we'll have to see the appeal of Bernie Sanders. Lots of people still feeling the burn, but then again, can he go up against the might of Donald Trump? 6:16 right now, coming up. Is owning a passport to travel a privilege or a right? We'll discuss next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Bob Marley there with Is This Love? Good morning, it's now 6:21 a.m. on Thursday, the 19th of May. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng. Taking a look at also other things in the news this morning. Now, Deputy Home Minister Datuk Nurjazla Mohamed, he said yesterday that passports allowing Malaysians to travel to and from the country are issued as a privilege and not a right. So he says that the power to allow people to go in and out of the country is with the Director General. And he also issues the passport, the Director General that is, which is a privilege and not a right. Of course, this is all coming on the back of news that Bursa 2.0 Chairman Maria Chin Abdullah was stopped last Sunday from flying to South Korea. And this was because she had received a human rights award for the group. So she was flying out, but she got stopped. What do you think about this, Julian? Do you have a position on whether passports are a privilege or a right?
I think the immediate reaction to this would be that to say that traveling and freedom of movement would be a matter of right? You don't want to be born knowing and feeling that your movements are restricted. So it's very unnatural to say that you can't go here or there. I mean, that's the starting position. But of course, there are instances where the government also has a right to restrict your movement of freedom of movement, say, because you're being investigated for criminal activities.
Yeah. So, you know, when I first read this and I thought, OK, I'm just trying to work it out in my mind. Is it a privilege or is it a right? You know, the cases where in the court they hold you for bail or bond, if I'm not mistaken, and then they hold your passport to prevent you from running out of the country or escaping. And I think that's an instance of when, you know, international travel or having a passport is a privilege, right? But I also assume that it's a right until you lose that right, until you abuse that privilege, if I'm not mistaken, or, you know, you conditional on certain things. So when I thought about it that way, I realized, oh, actually, you know, then Nurjazlan has a point, because if it is conditional upon certain things, then it is a privilege.
Well, I think that the only things that it should be conditional upon is if you commit a crime, if you harm your other fellow Malaysians, that's not part of that's not part of, I believe, the basic right, the basic human
right
for you to move around. But if you commit a crime, then of course those things can be reversed, because you need to be investigated and you need to be tried. And of course, if we believe that Malaysia is a democratic country, as a lot of our leaders tell us, Our leaders also tell us that the government, many times in the past, the government is not perfect, right? So the excuse or the reasoning that's being given here of people criticizing the country in foreign countries, it's that I don't think that's a bad thing, because as a democratic country and as a government who acknowledges that they're not perfect, then they should be open to some form of feedback.
Let's
put it that way. That's the kind of feedback, right?
So just to give some context to that, the Immigration Department had recently confirmed that there is in fact a new ruling to stop Malaysians who ridicule the government from travelling overseas. Now, apparently there was a source who said that the ruling was introduced a few months ago and that this overseas travel ban is for a period of 3 years. I don't know whether the travel ban is more to stop people from leaving the country and escaping investigation or punishment, rather than having stopped people from going out and, in a way, tarnishing the image of the ruling government to an overseas audience.
Yeah, exactly. So is criticizing the government a crime, right? Is it more a crime than criticizing somebody else, for instance? It's quite far out to think that the moment you criticize your government, because the governments can be changed, and if the governments can be changed through democratic elections, then people will continue to always criticize whichever the government of the day is.
Well, there's also that other piece of news that came out today saying that politicians and activists who are vocal should check their travel status with the Immigration Department before they make any trips. Now, I'm just wondering, I mean, it got me thinking, who would be checking these, who would think that they're on the blacklist, right? So those who think they're on the blacklist, perhaps are people who have something to fear, and that's why they want to check. But more often than not, people who speak out are people who think they're doing the right thing and may not necessarily go and check this blacklist on the Immigration Department. I have to say, I didn't realize there was a blacklist of the Immigration Department until this very morning.
I wonder if the travel insurance covers this, because you want to travel somewhere and find that you can't go because you're on a blacklist. Can you be reimbursed for that kind of thing?
So when I was speaking to my friends, I remember some of them expressing fear about not having paid off their PTPTN loans and being very worried that they would be barred from leaving the country. And I thought it was either a joke or like a neurosis. Perhaps they were worried about nothing. Now I'm thinking perhaps they did have something to worry about. Could, not paying off your PTPTN loan put you on the blacklist of the Immigration Department? That's something really concerning.
Melissa, I'm just wondering whether, and this is a personal question, while you were growing up, were your parents very protective about your movement? I mean, you being a girl, right? And I know many friends who are female, where they came from very protected homes and families. And for a good part of their childhood and into their teenage life and even beyond that in their 20s, their parents were very restrictive. And the more restrictive the parents were, the more these friends of mine wanted to go...
Rebel.
to rebel and to go out and to go crazy. Did you go through such a childhood?
Well, yes. I had a very sheltered... a childhood in terms of, I think it was a natural concern for my parents to be like, oh, we've got two girls, we must make sure we know where they are at all times. But I think my mother was quite reasonable in a sense that if you tell her where we are and there's constant checking in, so she's not worried. I think the key thing was she was always worried. Yeah. And if we took away that worry, we were okay to do what we wanted.
And I know friends who are from very draconian families, right? No disrespect to the elders there, who really had a very protective streak over the children. And the moment the children got the opportunity to go out or even to go overseas to study, they went crazy. They just had to make up for lost time, right? But for the families who were a little bit more liberal, and then when they got a chance to go out, they were just, meh. And they would just say, hey, I'd like to spend more time with my family. So it's a little bit of a kind of reverse psychology going on there in terms of with that control thing.
So you're trying to say that perhaps the a government should be more of a liberal parent than a strict parent.
I think so. I don't want my government to be like North Korea or to be like China, right? To restrict movements of people. Like North Koreans defect, right? They defect because things are so, situation is so bad at home.
I also want to say that I really hope that, you know, a passport is not a privilege. I really hope that it's a right, because what international travel has done to open up your minds and, you know, your horizons and seeing how other people live and questioning whether you could live a better life has really changed me. You know, think about all the places that you've gone, Jules, and how you've changed because of those holidays.
Yeah, exactly.
To be stuck under in just one place and not know the rest of the world is really quite a shame, because, you know, the world is so much bigger than KL, than Malaysia, right?
And also, I think, you know, it's really unfair advantage to use things like passport. It's like taking points off your driving license if you speed, right? I mean, that's very serious. Speeding and killing, you know, being a danger to other road users, very serious. But using a simple document as the passport as a kind of tool to restrict movement, we already have so much of the other kinds of laws that restrict your movement, the freedom of movement and things like that. And this is just adding to the whole thing, the whole list.
Well, tell us what you think. Do you think that a passport is a privilege or a right? Do you agree with the Deputy Home Minister, Nur Jazlan? Text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Is the passport to travel a privilege or a right? We've got the 6:30 news coming up now with Audrey Raj on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Bon Jovi there with You Give Love a Bad Name. 6:40 right now, it's Thursday the 19th of May. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng. Now, we've got a couple of tweets coming in regarding the passport issue, whether it's a privilege or a right. Who agrees with the Deputy Home Minister that it is in fact a right and not a privilege? Hiswani Hassan has weighed in saying that directors of companies who don't pay employees EPF contributions are barred from travel, and that has worked very well for the EPF.
And for its members, I must say.
Yeah, so this is to discourage those from trying to skirt the rules. Brian Ng says, of course, it's a right, not a privilege. So you agree with the Deputy Home Minister. Well, let us know why you think it's not a privilege. Why do you say it is a right? I would love to hear from you. 016-201-9000 is the number to text or tweet us at BFM Radio. But in the meantime, let's take a look at some other interesting things that have made the news today. In France, a high school dropout turned technology billionaire is now exporting his unconventional software engineering school to Silicon Valley. And this is to train future computer programmers. But the twist is, it's for free.
Yeah, what caught my attention was also the fact that he is a dropout. So there are many Silicon Valley dropouts. So they show the way, right? I mean, you have Bill Gates, you have Steve Jobs.
That's not a good promo for the parents sending their kids to school.
Exactly. So, this French guy says that current universities, especially good ones, are too expensive and too elitist. Which is true.
Mm-hmm.
It actually cuts out a large section of society from attending those schools. But I guess they have got qualification matters to think about, and which very high standards, which excludes the rest of society from entering. But, you know, do these guys know something that the so-called elitists don't know? They have found a way, and they're opening up this way. They found their riches in tech, and they're opening this up, giving free tech education away for free to the students.
So they're really changing up the way students learn in higher education, right? So Xavier Niel, he's a French guy who got started running an electronic sex chat and is the founder of Paris-based internet company Iliad. So now he's opening a branch of his tuition-free Parisian school, 42 in California.
You read that with a straight face, Melissa. Like, I mean, that's a red flag for me as well.
That
right?
he amassed his wealth running an electronic sex chat operation. Yeah, that was a red flag for me too.
but
I don't know
again,
if I want to send my kids to be studying at his school.
The founder of Wikipedia, which we all know, is a great engine today for all sorts of information, not necessarily of the you know, highest veracity, but still it's very, actually most of it is quite reliable, and if not, at least quite entertaining. The founder of Wikipedia made his money in the porn industry.
No,
yeah, not... Jimmy Wales.
Oh wow. Okay, all right. Well, let's
so
look
good
at
things can come from people who are involved in that sort of business.
Well, I don't know. Well, let's see whether you agree with his model for this free education. So this school, this Parisian school, is called 42. And what it is, it's a peer-to-peer learning model where students at a 200,000 square foot Fremont campus pay no tuition. They come and go freely day and night, and they have neither teachers nor lecturers. So they're assigned to programming projects for some of the school's research, with some of the school's research partners, and they're able to use all these really great hardware. The school is stocked with fantastic computers and everything you need to do to learn technology and to get this project out. So it's essentially project based.
I think a lot of students would love that kind of freedom, you know, to come and go as they please. Because I remember my student days, you know, sleeping till 2 p.m. in the afternoon, rock and rolling out of bed and, you know, having dinner and lunch. And I mean, the lines are so blurred between lunch and dinner. And before you know it, the time when I get to start doing my work, it's already at midnight or something. And it's a vicious circle, right? It goes on to the next day. But this model is very attractive to students to use the time in their own way, and you never know when you're going to get that burst of creativity.
Okay, so this part of me is going to be quite skeptical, as I have also been a lazy student in university.
That's a pattern.
Well,
here,
you know, at that point of your life, you sometimes struggle to find focus, and you're often distracted with other more tempting things in life than studies. And education. But, you know, this is a peer-to-peer learning model. So you're essentially learning from your other classmates. So you sit down together and work on a project and learn together.
And also consultants, actually. They work with...
consultants.
And it's very project-driven. It's not like a nanny state. I mean, talking about this passport thing, right?
It's a nanny state.
You want to be results-driven. Why are you restricted from travel? Instead of just saying, I restrict you from travel, say... I want a better country, for instance, right? Results rather than the mode of control.
You know, there's a part of me that thinks, okay, I like the idea that they're working on a project together, that they are learning teamwork, which is, I'm sure, very important in tech startups and places like Silicon Valley. I like the fact that it's kind of on-the-job training, right? So you're not learning from a textbook and then later having to apply it to real life. Those things I like, but I wonder whether it's an alternative to traditional classroom methods of learning. I think there's something to be said about someone with authority and maturity and expertise guiding young students along the way. So kind of teaching them, imparting knowledge. There's so much more to a teacher or a lecturer than just lectures or classroom notes. There's that discussion, and there's the imparting of knowledge and wisdom, and that hopefully takes place in a classroom. So if you remove the classroom and you remove all sorts of restrictions, essentially this is a startup culture in a university.
Yeah, it's really disrupting traditional ways of education. And, you know, the tech world is actually a very artificial world, even though it's become a lot of people's reality, right? They wake up, they switch on the monitor and they stare into a screen. So that's a very artificial world. And you're right, Melissa, because it removes you from traditional ways of learning where you get the wisdom. And I guess things like the arts, you know, things like literature and letter writing, may not put food on your table anymore. And so these guys are focusing on other things. And mind you, these are things that they may enjoy, programming, switching on a monitor. And perhaps this may spur the kind of passion in them.
We've spoken to many a business school, a B school, and a huge deans of huge universities on The Breakfast Grill. And one question I always often pose to them is about MOOCs, the massive open source learning, right? I wonder whether
I love those.
Well, so you're a proponent of that. For me, I wonder whether it's complementary or if it's a competitor. And I like the fact that with MOOCs, students are driven themselves. You know, there's a certain discipline. Students have to go and they have to desire, they have to want it, basically.
Yeah.
But then you also see a huge dropout number because students are not. And without the kind of incentive of having a teacher kind of coach you, guide you, and encourage you to be there, and it's just kind of based, it's like having a gym buddy. Go to the gym today. Get someone to kind of spur you to go to the gym. If it was just up to you, you'd be like, I think
the teacher or the lecturer is not really the disincentive or the incentive. I think it's really the end result of what you want to achieve, which over the long term, I think it's survival, right? You need to have a job. And that this kind of MOOCs structure will give you that free learning experience. And I think that for me, over the long term, it gives people a lot of hope because educational costs. I mean, we ran that Ring and Sense episode of how education is so expensive and parents have to fund their children's education at the expense of their own retirement. It's this kind of free learning structure that gives me a lot of hope for the future because this is taking that freemium economy right down to people's lives. They can now be educated for free. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, can I just say that that was one of my favorite Ringgit and Sense interviews that you did. I highly recommend you go and download the podcast. I listen to it on bfm.my. It's under Ringgit and Sense. It's the trade-off between education and your retirement. How much are you giving away of your retirement savings when you send your children for private education? So check that out. That's really interesting. 6:50 right now, and we've got Hanging Around by the Counting Crows coming up next on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.